Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Look, we get it. Valentine's Day is, well...
Perfection, at least in this realm, does not exist and never, ever will. But love does, and home is wherever love is.
With all the talk about love this time of year, it kind of drowns out how we really feel about each other and about home. Today's show is kind of a Valentine for Appalachia.
I moved to West Virginia because I wanted to be here, and I've never wanted to leave.
There's a way of life here that mountain folks adhere to that others can't understand.
Okay, and we couldn't help ourselves. We also sat down to ask a couple who's been married for nearly 70 years how they managed to stay together.
If you trust somebody and love somebody, you don't have any problems.
It's been easy. She's a great wife, a wonderful mother, and she's my best friend.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This week's episode of Inside Appalachia is all about love. Not the florist and jewelry store version of love, but love for something even more deep. Love for home. Love for family. Love for the mountains of Appalachia. And we'll talk a little bit about being in love, too. The pull of the mountains is strong. For most of my life, I've heard stories that people who leave their homes in Appalachia will likely find their way back. For some, it may take until they retire, but they never stop thinking of the mountains as home. And yes, maybe like you, many people from here have strong but complicated emotions about this place we call home. In Virginia, the saying goes that Virginia is for lovers, so we're pretty excited to start off our show today with a love letter from that state. Here's Rance Garrison, who lives in Southwest Virginia, who wrote this love story for Appalachia.
For better or for worse, through sickness and in health, for richer or poorer. Committing to a place in a community is a lot like committing to a marriage. It takes work. It takes willpower. It takes dedication. But above all else, it takes love. As a relatively newly and happily married man, I can tell you firsthand that love is the not-so-secret ingredient in any relationship. The struggles of day-to-day life, the bouts with sickness, the financial stress that most newlyweds face, it can all be conquered by love, and love is ultimately what has kept my wife and I going strong for 6 years now as a couple, and for 8 months as a married couple. I have my reservations about trying to compare living in Appalachia, or anywhere else for that matter, to something as sacred as marriage. However, when I really break it down and examine marriage as the beginning point of many families, including my own, and when I trace my own family line back through over a century of people who lived and died in these ruggedly beautiful mountains, a line that includes farmers and prison guards and automobile mechanics and coal miners and storekeepers and mothers and fathers and husbands and wives, I can see where you could definitely draw those similarities. As I approach my 29th year on this planet, family is becoming more important to me than ever before. I've already lost most of my grandparents, and I know that I will not have the wisdom of older generations to draw on forever, and there will come a time in the near future when I will have children of my own to guide and to mold to the best of my ability. And there will also come a time, hopefully several decades down the line, when my own life will draw to a close and it will be time for me to exit the stage, hopefully with grace and dignity, having left things in my community and in my world at least a little bit better than they were when I got here, and having left something of value for generations to come. My family is here, and that's why when I think of Appalachia in general and Southwest Virginia in particular, I can only think of home. No, this place isn't perfect. Its economic struggles have been well documented, and its spiritual ones have been as well. But you show me a perfect city. Show me a perfect community. Show me a perfect family or a perfect marriage or a perfect human being, and I will show you a carefully crafted facade. Perfection, at least in this realm, does not exist and never, ever will. But love does, and home is wherever love is. And for better or worse, I'm home. Till death do his part.
Rance Garrison is a singer-songwriter and graduate student who currently lives in Norton, Virginia, with his wife, Andrea. Next, another story about home that was sent to us by Jeff Canode, a preacher in Alderson, West Virginia. He wrote an essay about his appreciation of the place he calls home these days. Here's an excerpt from his essay called Home and Change.
I left Greenbrier County in 2012 after calling the valley home for 5 years. This summer, my wife Kelly and I returned, once again destined to call this place home. So much never changes. The graceful beauty of the land, the gracious beauty of the people, the eclectic mix of tradition and something new perpetually commingling in the cultural life of this place. It's the timelessness of the breathtaking surroundings that makes the Greenbrier Valley mystical, like those blue mountains which shelter it. It's the diversity of the creative people who make up the population here that makes this valley a community. We Methodist pastors itinerate, just like those circuit riders who brought our church to these mountains over 200 years ago. In nearly 20 years being a Methodist preacher, I have called many other places home. Each town leaves its imprint in my soul, and I can only pray I leave something positive of myself there, too. I carry light and grace, lessons and humbling with me in every breath and in every footstep, from parishes from Crumpler and Chillion to Ona and Glenville. Moving around from church to church in the shadow of faithful Francis Asbury and his all-suffering horse has great emotional challenges. In the past, I have experienced feelings of disorientation and rootlessness that quickly take over my mental well-being. Over the years, I have met people with such deep, profound connection to the town, to the church, to their fellow church members, whom they have known since childhood. And I, as their pastor, can only ask, who am I, arriving so late among such ancient connectiveness? When and where will I or my family ever know such sacred roots?
That was Jeff Canode offering his own love letter to his home in the Greenbrier Valley. Jeff has published several books of nonfiction and is a pastor at the Alderson United Methodist Church. We've posted an extended version of his essay called Home and Change on our website, wvpublic.org. Next, we're going to hear a story about another topic many of us have a love-hate relationship with, winter. This time of year, the darkness and the cold can become exhausting, and driving in the winter can be treacherous, especially in remote, high-altitude regions. But sometimes, in rural communities, help is there when you need it the most. Glennis Board experienced that a few years ago when she was traveling in Preston County. Here's Glennis with her love story about winter in rural West Virginia.
I had to drive out to Preston County the other day. It's a haul, one I know well, but haven't made for a while. Not since I moved away from my Arthurdale home a couple years ago. Of course, the weather was bad. In Preston County, it stays winter all through winter. So I dreaded the dicey Pee County winter slippy roads. You gotta drive around tight turns, because when you pass through, you're constantly feeling for fishtails and finding them, usually as someone is passing the other way. And in those moments, everything tightens. I finally pulled into the doctor's office, and no sooner had the door open than a couple in a nearby car called out to me, "Hey, you got a flat?" Of course I do. I thank them for pointing it out. Hurry inside. On the way out, I mentioned in the waiting room that I need to find the nearest place to fill my tire with air, or try to. One man in Carhartt jacket and pants tells me there's a gas station just down the road, but, he says, under a raised eyebrow, "You'll have to pay 50 cents. Then he gets up, starts walking towards the door, saying, I have a pump in my car. Of course you do. This is Preston County, where the unofficial motto is, we've been stuck before. I followed this guy out, and he proceeds to try to put air in my tire, pointing to all the telltale nicks and creases that indicate that the tire isn't likely to hold any pressure at all. It's cold. Even my 2-year-old mentions it. Then this guy says, it's supposed to drop to negative 12 in Terra Alta tonight. I guess if you live out there, you got to expect that, I replied. Then he said something that stuck with me and woke me up in the middle of the night to record the memory. He said, you know, though, it seems like I'm never warmer than when I'm in Terra Alta. That took me aback a little, kind of poetic. His words resonated with me. I guess they resonated with him, too, because he repeated himself. Yeah, it might be cold everywhere, but it seems like I'm always warm in Terra Alta. Meanwhile, the tire stayed flat. The man advised me to take it up to the Walmart, warned me not to be taken advantage of by so-and-so, who would try to point out every problem your car had and charge too much to fix it. Then I was on my way. Slowly. Next thing, Walmart waiting tire room. And several friendly faces reassuring me that it would all work out. I believed them. Reluctantly. An hour and $7.50 later, after a series of altogether pleasant conversations and a show-and-tell of how impressively ruined my tire was, I was on my way. It was getting late, and it was cold, really cold. The wind picked up. The snow started blowing sideways. I'm driving on a spare tire and a prayer. Of course. I'm in Preston County. This was so typical. But coming up over the hills, the sky appeared. And it looked like a Japanese painting. I could see some planet gleaming low on the horizon, like a diamond in the sky. The gusty blue and gray and white scene was so pretty. And, you know, I just felt so warm. Of course I did. I love Preston County.
Again, that was Glynis Ward. She originally wrote that story in 2015. I sometimes feel that those kind of random acts of kindness are exactly what makes the people of Appalachia our greatest treasure. A couple weeks ago, we asked you to send in your love letters to Appalachia. One listener, Betty Rivard, talked about her passion for West Virginia by sharing more about a project she created. Turns out the project might even make it easier to share your own love letters. You see, I'll let Betty explain. She's a transplant to West Virginia, but once she got here, she never left.
My name is Betty Rivard. I've lived in West Virginia, mostly in rural parts of the state, since 1971. I moved to West Virginia because I wanted to be here, and I've never wanted to leave. After I retired from working for the state as a social worker and planner, I became a fine art landscape photographer. One of the things I did was design a line of note cards where I put my original photographs on the front, printed on the back with some words that I wrote that I wanted to use to characterize my love for the state. So I thought the most helpful thing might be if I read those words. I started out mountain soul. And I want you to think about each of these words and see how it resonates for you. Beautiful. Calm, deep, shy, individual, vigorous, compassionate, tough-minded, quick-witted, and eternal. I can't think of a better way to characterize the qualities that I find here that I did not find, at least in the same mix, in the other places where I live.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us, Betty. We'll hear more of your love letters for Appalachia in just a bit. But first, it's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. This week, because we're exploring stories themed around love, we're going to head to a town in Tennessee where you might take your sweetheart for a kiss. Is it Tunnel of Love, Amore, or Sweet Lips? We'll have the answer after the break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Take this heart of gold and melt it down. Then I'll come around. I'll come around. I'm treading lightly in your eyes. And honey, I can't live a life. But a life without you could never steal.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So did you guess Sweet Lips, Tennessee? Then you're right. Sweet Lips is located just outside of the boundaries of Appalachia, but it had such a sweet name, we had to find out the story. Did it get its name for a hot little number at a kissing booth? Well, we actually first featured the town of Sweet Lips back in 2015. For the scoop, we called up Lifetime area resident Nancy Canada, who at the time was working at the Chester County Public Library.
Thanks so much for helping us out with this week's What's in a Name segment. We just had to find out where Sweet Lips, Tennessee got its name. So what story did you hear growing up?
Okay, of course, Sweet Lips is in the middle of a rural area in the middle of a very rural county. And the story that I always heard was that a traveler was passing through and of course on foot, and he needed water, and the water that he was given, he said, "This tastes so sweet to my lip." And there is a book that we have in our local library called Passing Gas, and it's about different small towns in America that are very oddly named, and Sweet Lips is in there, and they quote Mr. J.C. Pickett, who ran the Sweet Lips store for years and years, and he said that during the Civil War, there were soldiers that came through, and they were mapping and surveying the area, and they were very thirsty, and they drank out of a stream, and they said, "This tastes so sweet to my lips." So that area on their maps was became known as Sweet Lips, and it's still that to this day.
Nancy Canada has since retired. But we love that story and just had to re-air it in time for Valentine's Day. So that's how Sweet Lips, Tennessee got its name. If you have another story about Sweet Lips or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet to InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name. Did you know that humans, of course, aren't the only animals who have long-term monogamous relationships? Eagles do too. Several years ago, our producer Roxy Todd visited the Three Rivers Avian Center to hear the story of a couple of married eagles who made the New River Gorge their home. This is a story about love, tragedy, and new beginnings.
In Summers County, West Virginia, there's a refuge and rehabilitation center for injured eagles, falcons, hawks, owls, and songbirds. Ron and Wendy Peroni have been directing the Avian Center for 24 years. That's just about as long as the 28 years that they've been married. Ron says humans aren't the only ones who form powerful long-term bonds with their mates.
We've heard of red tails, hawks, caring for a mate that's been on the ground for years, leading them to food, leading them to water, and defending them. You know, they're amazing that way.
Ron and Wendy work as a team, and together they've helped rescue almost 4,000 birds. In fact, while I was at the Avian Center, a man called and asked if they could come help a red-tailed hawk that he'd found. So I went along with Wendy and Ron on a rescue mission to the nearby town of Pax, and there we met Ira Turner and this hawk.
I found a big hawk back in the mountains. He's hurt or sick, I don't know what it is, so I thought I'd give y'all a call so y'all could come get him, take care of him.
That red-tailed hawk, by the way, it's now doing much better. It had some big bruises near its wing where it might have been hit by a car. But despite all of this tremendous work, Ron and Wendy aren't able to save every raptor they see. last year, a 9-year-old female bald eagle named Streaky was killed after she crashed into an Amtrak train. Her mate Whitey was killed when he flew into the same train in 2013. For years, the pair had nested and raised about 7 young eagles together right along the road near the Avian Center. Many people, including Ron and Wendy, had grown used to seeing them raise their young year after year.
They were very tender with each other and very caring for each other and lots of talking back and forth and back and forth. And it was just a joy to watch them.
And like some human couples, this pair of eagles had a particular routine whenever they were adding to their nest.
You know, they would go breaking twigs and branches off of trees when they were working on their nest. He would drag something in and he'd fiddle with it and get it where he wanted. And she always would pick it up and move it. She was never satisfied with the way he arranged the furniture in the nest.
And unlike many smaller birds, male raptors and eagles even share some of the responsibility of raising the young.
You know, they can play with each other. They get up in the air. And when they get their young up there and they have to teach them to catch stuff, it's a game. One will have something and then they'll throw it to the other one and see if the other one can catch it out of the air.
Last year, after Streaky the bald eagle hit the same train that had killed her mate, she returned to their nest for 9 days, trying to recoup. But when she went out for food, she ran straight into a truck. Wendy and Ron found Streaky and brought her to their refuge. They tested her for lead poisoning, which causes brain damage and disorientation in many birds of prey.
She came in contaminated with lead, which we kind of expected. You know, they come in because they've been hit by a car, right? You test them for lead, and they're positive, and they've got a good load of it. Well, they probably were flying drunk, basically.
Lead poisoning, which very well could be the reason Streaky and Whitey both had their accidents, comes from eating fish and other meat that's contaminated. But if Wendy and Ron can catch the lead poisoning in time, they usually have a lot of success cleaning it out of a raptor system. They did get Streaky's lead levels down, but her injuries were just too extensive, and she died at their refuge. But Wendy says that a new pair of bald eagles have taken up house in Whitey and Streaky's old nest. They decided to name these eagles Brooks and Sandy.
They're hanging out there. They're adding to the nest. There's lots of mating going on and lots of loving back and forth. So we have hopes for chicks in the nest this year.
In the New River Gorge, the bald eagle population is growing. This January, 56 bald eagles were counted here. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Summers County.
That story originally aired in 2015, and according to Wendy Peroni with the Three Rivers Avian Center, they are seeing a new pair of eagles around the nest that Streaky and Whitey once called home. But Wendy says all the eagles are slower to nest this year, and she isn't sure if there will be a young eagle hatchling at the Brooks River nest. Still, the eagle numbers so far have continued to rise across the New River Gorge the past couple of years, according to the wildlife experts who conduct the yearly eagle survey each fall. Our next love letter to Appalachia is from a man I'm proud to call my friend. Alan Johnston is a musician who lives in McDowell County, West Virginia. Here's Alan reading a piece he calls My Mountain Home.
I'm thankful to God that He allowed me to be born and raised in the heart of Appalachia. There's a way of life here that mountain folks adhere to that others can't understand. There's a way of thinking that's instilled in mountain folks that outsiders just don't get. But I don't care. Let them wonder. I grew up in a place where everyone I knew believed in God, and they had a fearful respect for Him. Now, when I was young, I didn't know one person who was brave enough to swear to God to a lie. And folks had a common knowledge of sinful lifestyles, and the ones who practiced those things did their best to keep it hidden from others. We prayed in school, said the Pledge of Allegiance. We got our butts busted when we did wrong and got them busted again when we got home. I have a lot of fond memories of my childhood in Appalachia, like wood-burning cook stoves and drawing water from the well, and that warm morning coal stove on a cold winter day, big family get-togethers, playing fiddles and banjos and guitars all night long, playing in the mountains until almost dark. It was all good, except for maybe no plumbing in the house, but I didn't know any better, so that wasn't so bad at the time either. If I had it to do over again and God would let me pick where I was going to be raised, I'd do it in the same exact place I was raised the first time. I love my mountain home.
Got that sweet mountain soul down in my bones. I can feel it when I sing them lonesome songs. I can tell by the way I feel that it comes from somewhere real, like that sweet mountain soul down in my bones.
Thanks, Alan, and everyone who shared your love letters to Appalachia with us. We'll hear from a few more of you at the end of our show. Now for a love story of sorts. This includes an artist. Most ceramics are made in factories these days, but many of our Appalachian ancestors made their pottery by hand. It was something often done out of necessity and love, creating utensils, plates, and bowls for their family to eat with. And today, a lot of artists still make pottery, but it's rare to find someone who sources their own clay. And a potter in Preston County, West Virginia, does just that. He digs up clay in his own backyard, not just because he loves it, but also for love. Our Folkways reporter Caitlin Tan has the story.
Mel Sword's house is a little off the beaten path. It's a lengthy drive off the main road.
Hi! I was hoping I had the right place.
There's a large grassy meadow in front of and behind his house. To the left is his shop where he makes his pottery. Mel wears narrow circle glasses, a rugged workshop apron. He talks to you like you're old friends. Before I can shake his hand, he tells me about the special kind of dirt on his property.
After time, it turns to shale. See, this is, you know, but this was clay at one time.
Mel specifically bought this piece of property because of the clay. While building his home, he piled all the clay into a large mound behind his house.
See that pile up there? That's all clay.
That pile is about 7 feet tall and 15 feet wide.
I have a lifetime plus.
It doesn't look like the big blocks of clay one typically sees. It looks more like heavy dirt. It's technically clay soil right now, but it's the timely process of turning that soil into a moldable product that Mel enjoys. It's a process potters had to do before the industry was commercialized. Rene Margosi is a professional potter and executive director of the Tamrac Foundation for the Arts. She says in the early days in Appalachia, people had to source their own clay too, much like Mel.
Pottery is just something that is actually a necessary thing to have in your life. Clay is something that can be found everywhere. And so you can literally use what is close at hand to create an object that is utilitarian.
Mel's been making pottery for much of his life, but he really only started digging clay about 15 years ago for, well, love. He took his then-girlfriend, now-wife, camping outside of Morgantown.
We were hiking through the rain. I saw the clay water coming off the hill, and I knew that there was clay there. So I just went over there and scooped a little bit of it up.
And he formed the clay into little round beads and left them in the campfire coals. And in the morning, he said,
"Here, sweetie, here's some West Virginia pearls."
And that's become Mel's side business in retirement. He's the person who can make you West Virginia pearls. Renee says hand-digging clay is labor-intensive, and it's not for everyone. especially when it's turned to a chunky, dry substance.
There will be a lot of different organic matter in, so there might be twigs and rocks and burrs.
That's the sound of Mel using what looks like a very large mortar and pestle. He handmade it out of a garage door spring, some pipe, and a few other things lying around. He's crushing up the chunky, dry clay into a fine sand.
After this is pulverized some, I just put it in this screen.
It's basically a window screen that keeps bugs out. Mel uses it to filter out the twigs and rocks as he slowly pours the clay sand into a bucket.
So, you know, I just keep doing this until the bucket is full.
He says it takes him about 4 hours to fill 1 5-gallon bucket.
I'm the kind of person who likes to do monotonous jobs. And this is very monotonous. And then, come in here, I'll show you. And after that,
he adds water until it's a thick, muddy substance using a drill attached to an old paint stirrer. After several days, Mel removes any excess water that doesn't absorb using a
turkey baster.
The clay then sits in a mold that absorbs any remaining moisture. And after that, Mel's ready to work. He still likes to use a foot pedal powered table or a kick wheel to make things like pots, bowls, and mugs. And although there are electric powered tables these days, that's not Mel's style. In his studio, the surface of the table spins around and around. It looks kind of like a spool. The hunk of red clay sits in the middle, and Mel is able to shape it with his hands while the wheel spins. He's making a mug.
And you want to get the piece centered. You want to center it through and through. There. It's pretty good now.
And this is something Mel does pretty much year-round. He sells some of his work, but it's not his objective. He just really enjoys the process of it all. And Renee says every potter should have that intimate experience with clay at least once. Although she admits that if one wants to sell pottery on a large scale, processing found clay is not the most efficient. However, it is still a part of our Appalachian history.
There's a romantic element to understanding it from the beginning to the end, and there's extreme value in that.
And Mel hopes to invite students in sometime to show them his love for the process. But if you want to try to find some West Virginia clay, Mel suggests keeping your eyes peeled after a rainstorm, especially on muddy back roads. Look for red spines in the ditch or in the banks of rivers. Who knows? Maybe you'll even be able to try your hand at a West Virginia pearl for someone you love. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Preston County, West Virginia.
Valentine's Day isn't a favorite holiday for everybody, especially people who aren't in a romantic relationship, I'd say. But what if it could still be something special? A few years ago, we learned of a project one small West Virginia town did to exchange hundreds of love letters with strangers from across the country. Back in 2015, Roxy Todd went to record this story about a community that did an unusual Valentine's-themed art project called Love Letters from Thomas.
Last year, folks in Thomas, West Virginia, handwrote hundreds of letters to send to another small town that was chosen basically at random. The idea was to remind people that someone out there, someone that they never even met, really and genuinely cares. Gail Snyder lives in Madrid, New Mexico. Last winter, she was one of the people who received one of those love letters.
It was this total surprise, and everyone had their own private experience of going to their mailbox and finding this mysterious thing in the mailbox. It was addressed to fellow human being. It was like we got this special blessing or something from these strangers that none of us knew.
These whimsical letters were part of a community art project organized by Art Spring. Audrey Stephenson is an AmeriCorps volunteer who helped organize the project.
Well, I thought it was an amazing idea right off the bat. I thought that just what
What a sweet thing to do.
Seth Pitt first had the idea. He's an artist who co-owns the White Room Art Gallery in Thomas.
This was a thing that I used to do. I used to write letters to strangers, and I thought maybe it would even be a little bit more impactful if everyone was sitting around in a room together, all trying to send out goodwill to their fellow humans on this earth. I do think that a large part of this project, its goal is to make people not feel so isolated from one another.
People who live in the towns of Madrid and Thomas learned that they do share some similarities. They're both former coal mining towns, which have had to find other ways to survive when the coal mines in their town shut down. One town in the desert and another in the Appalachian Mountains, somehow connected by these little pages of art.
It gave us all hope, I think. You know, hope that we aren't just these isolated little communities struggling.
So last year, the residents in Madrid were inspired to start their own project, and they sent similar letters to another small town in New Mexico. So far, Gail says, they haven't heard back. But Seth says that some of the people in Madrid actually decided to just write back to the people in Thomas.
One of the coolest stories was that one of the kids around here, she sent a little piece of her art, and it landed in the mailbox of an artist who lived out there. And the lady replied to her and kind of critiqued her art and told her what she liked about it. And that prompted the girl who lived here to send her another piece of art. And they're still exchanging letters to this day, which is pretty cool.
The last few weeks, Seth, Audrey, and other folks in Thomas have begun another letter-writing campaign, this time for residents of a small town in West Virginia.
I don't know if I want to tell you the town, because then they'll all know that they're coming. And we kind of like it to be a surprise.
So for now, we'll leave it a mystery for you to ponder. But I will say this. All you cynics out there, watch out. A stranger could disarm all of your objections to Valentine's Day with a singular, unexpected love letter, reminding you that someone out there, someone who doesn't even know your name, sends their love. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Thomas.
That story originally aired in 2015. We checked in with Seth Pitt, and he says they haven't done their love letter project in several years. Bummer. But some of them do still keep in touch with their pen pals they connected with in New Mexico. Today we're talking about love in and for Appalachia. There are so many lovely songs about love, murder, love lost, and longing across the Appalachian Mountains. One example is The Soldier and the Lady, performed by Tab Ward in the 1960s. It's a true love song and is about a soldier who comes back from the war in a disguise and stops to talk with his lover in her garden. Let's listen to a bit of the song.
Jolly young soldier come riding by, and at the word he did address her, saying, "Pretty fair miss, won't you marry me?" "No, sir, no, sir. I'm a girl of thunder, a man of thunder you may be. You mustn't repose on the fair young lady. To marry you this bright summer day." "Madam, I have gold and silver. Madam, I have house and land. Madam, I live where all pleasure. It's all I want. Take me for your
That was Tab Ward singing The Soldier and the Lady, recorded in the 1960s by a North Carolina toy maker and song collector named Jack Guy. Thanks to the W.L. Urey Appalachian Collection in Beech Mountain, North Carolina, for that recording. We don't have time to listen to the entire song, but we recommend that you do. Spoiler alert, it has a happy ending. Most Appalachian love ballads end on a sad note, but we decided to offer a lighter side of love in this Valentine's episode of Inside Appalachia. You can listen to the full song on our website, wvpublic.org. Another love story right here in our offices has been going on for nearly 70 years. Here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, there is a man who works at our station who has become something of a legend. Frank Stowers is a part-time host of our classical music programming. Roxy Todd sat down with Frank and his wife of 67 years, Amita Stowers, to hear their story.
Roxy, our having met and married is almost like a fairy tale. Amita had come to the States for a couple of years to study and then had just gone back to Mexico and started working as an English Spanish secretary when I appeared on the scene to participate in a work camp somewhat like the Peace Corps run by the Methodist Church in the mountains of Puebla. And at the end of that summer, I was so taken with the experience that I decided to remain in Mexico and do graduate work in Latin American studies. And so it turns out she spent 2 years in the States and I spent 2 years in Mexico. We met in the Methodist Church in Mexico City in the choir. And it's at that point that I turn it over to Amita to tell you how we happened to meet.
I was always singing in the choir, and the rehearsal was every Wednesday. Every Thursday, and I was sitting there and in rows, and all of a sudden I heard somebody touching my hair. I was long hair, and I turned around, and it was Frank. and I didn't say anything, and he didn't say anything. But then after rehearsal, the whole group went out and have coffee in some of the coffee shops around the church. So that's how we met then. We started talking.
How many years ago was this? How long have you two been married?
It is 67 years ago.
Wow.
People wonder how a relationship like that could last for 67 years. It's been easy. She's a great wife, a wonderful mother, and she's my best friend. And besides, we are thoroughly married. When you marry in Mexico, the first thing you discover is that there is complete separation of church and state. And so we were married in a government office, and then a month later, we married in the church. Of course, the reason for the time lapse, she had to have time to have her papers fixed in order to be able to come to the States. But it was rather cute because during that month's time, she didn't know whether to call herself Mrs. Stowers or if she was still Amita Sanchez. But that was really an interesting experience because things are just reversed down there. The man holds the rehearsal ceremony, and the woman just shows up. Our relationship, I think, is unique. Amita spent enough time in the States that she came to love Americans and things in this country. The language, the literature, all the things that represents the United States. I, in turn, fell deeply in love with everything related to Mexico. I loved the language, the literature, the history, the music, the customs. I could have remained there and been perfectly happy. So we had an awful lot in common from the very beginning that I think just created the glue that stuck us together. We enjoyed too much of the same things. There was one other thing, since we're talking about Valentine's Day and romance. It was the custom while I was there, and it probably still exists, that if a fella has a girlfriend that he really cares about, he'll take a group of friends or maybe a professional band, and he'll serenade under her window at night. And there were several of us in the church choir that were dating at that time, and we all went out and sang under our girls' windows. Now, the interesting thing is that if for some reason the girl is not too pleased with this, she could follow up by dumping water on the guys from her window. Fortunately, that never happened to me.
Was there a song in particular you remember singing beneath Amita's window?
Well, there's one in particular, Roxy. Imagine on a moonlight night, you're standing in your window, and your sweetheart is down below with his friends, and they're singing this song. It's one that folks in this country know pretty well. It's called Estrellita, Little Star. The words to this song are, "Little star, come down and tell me that you love me a little, because I can't live without your love. You are, little star, my beacon of love. Come down and tell me that you love me just a little, because I can't live without your love." That's typical of love songs in Mexico, and that is a very romantic experience.
Advice on how to keep a relationship like this going after all these years?
Well, the first place, we love each other, and that's very important. And you just have to trust each one as the time goes by, and adjust to the new living. Because, you know, neither of us was married before, and it was new for both of us. But then it was not difficult. It was easy because we trust each other, we love each other, and we wanted to have a nice marriage. Sometimes when we are in different places and they know that I am from Mexico and Frank is American, they want to know how come we have lasted so long. And if you trust somebody and love somebody, you don't have any problems at all. But unfortunately, so many times the relationship doesn't last. But it has to be within you. And we are blessed enough that we have found each other, that we are suitable to each other.
I think the important thing is that you have to think of the other person. As long as you're wrapped up in your own interests and your own concerns and your own activities and shut the other person out, that can almost guarantee problems. But if you live with the other person always in your mind, and you are concerned about making life better for that person, no matter how many years go by, that's almost a guarantee of a successful marriage. She's a great gal, and I'd do it over again.
Frank, you do classical music here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Is there a song that you can think of that symbolizes your relationship with your wife or the romance that you guys have had?
Yes, Roxy. I'd have to say that it's a piece called Lisboa Antigua, in Old Lisbon. It was quite popular in Mexico in the 50s and was played frequently in places where we would go dancing, and it soon became our song.
Close out our show with one more love letter for Appalachia that was submitted by Willa Johnson from Kentucky.
Appalachian love stories exist beyond people. Sometimes our love stories are between the land and us. Heaven knows staying in our communities isn't an easy path to take. For me, it's a long, twisted trail up the mountain behind my Papo Hillard's house. My path starts where the gravel ends on the hillside, and the smell of rotten apples fallen from the trees attracts bees in August. There sits a cemetery. It's small and hard to get to when your purpose is laying someone in their final resting place. I have stood here several times in my life. I remember when there was just one headstone here, one solitaire stone for a man I never knew. Then one warm October day, just past my 9th birthday, my great-granny Hat took her place next to that headstone. Years have passed and more headstones have appeared. Tears have been shed many times there on that hillside, overlooking the plots of land that I spent my childhood playing hide and seek with cousins. The faint smell of Sunday cookouts still roams through the air, even though the practice was abandoned years ago. Laughter has been shared here too. After all, this was prime sleigh riding land. One winter as a teenager, a surprise snowstorm had hit and we didn't have a sleigh in sight. We piled on layers of clothes and visited Papaw for trash bags from under his kitchen sink. Dollar store trash bags, a foot of snow, and us girls made memories that we draw on every winter to cheer each other up. The garden is adjacent to the cemetery. When I was little, a possum was caught in the living trap there. I wasted hours one day admiring his frozen stance in the cages as he stood on his hind feet with one hand clasping the top of the cage, staring without blinking, so still that one trickle of drool hung from his gaping mouth at the end of his tongue. Every year there's a count of how many copperheads are killed in that garden. Past the cemetery is a tree line and the mountain trail. When I was a little girl, I would walk the trails with my dad as he hunted. He would take his 12-gauge and I had my wooden toy rifle. Once we barely cleared the tree line when a bee stung me through my white bobby socks and got stuck in the material, so my dad pulled it out with his bare hands, also getting stung. We turned around and made our way back down the hillside to our house so that my mom could take care of my sting and give my dad a shot with his EpiPen. These hunting trips were pretty unfruitful in terms of killing any animals, but full of memories about how to swing from a grapevine. In my 20s, my papaw called to tell me he had hiked the mountain after hearing something in the middle of the night. He found a giant boulder there that landed not too far from a nearby mining company who had blasted the mountain. When I went with the camera to take pictures the next day, he told me he suspected it was gone. He had heard machinery working through the night. Sure enough, his property had been trespassed, and the boulder was gone. But Papaw said to leave it alone. He was too old to fight about it. That mountainside was the constant in my childhood. It provided me with scenes for my imagination to run wild. Fresh water that could be piped to our house when the tank in our city water system went dry for 2 months. A place to grieve and honor family members, and a place to see growth every spring and summer when my Papaw's garden began to bloom. I sometimes don't credit that mountain enough, but it was a character in my life as much as any human has been. That mountain is what keeps calling me back.
Willa Johnson is the director of the Appalachian Media Institute at Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky. Since she originally recorded that story for us in 2015, Willa's pawpaw has passed away.
Hunter, won't you fly away? I close my eyes in case you stay.
Till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Our music this week was also provided by Dinosaur Burps, Alan Cathead Johnston, Martika and William, Andrea Tomase, and special thanks to our friends at Mountain Stage who helped gather songs from their archives by Tyler Childers and Mandolin Orange. Also, thanks to the W.I. Urey Appalachian Collection in Beech Mountain, North Carolina for their help finding old-time music for this episode. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Glennis Ford. Kara Lofton edited our show this week. Xander Alloy helps promote our show. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There you can also subscribe or download all of our stories, or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.